Good afternoon, everyone. Distinguished members of the panel, Mr. Victor Vavrika and Professor Vitit Munterborn, excellencies, distinguished guests, colleagues from the region, ladies and gentlemen. It is my great pleasure to welcome you to this discussion meeting to launch the 9th in the series of IOM and the Migration Policy Institute's Issues in Brief. This one, titled The Global Forum on Migration and Development, Perspectives from Asia and the Pacific. The purpose of the issues in brief are to discuss and explore evolving migration issues in the region. And this paper comes at a critical juncture in the evolution of the GFMD and global discussions on migration and development generally. I would like to thank Secretary Imelda Nichols and Ms. Dovlin Agunius for producing this paper, which makes a concrete contribution to the regional debate and includes recommendations on the future of the GFMD. For our outside guests, this is actually part of a training that we are running. So the people in the back, and some actually now sitting in the front, are here from IOM offices all over the region and being trained in the area of labour migration. So welcome, of course, to my IOM colleagues as well as to our guests. Next week's GFMD meeting in Sweden comes on the heels of last year's second high-level dialogue on migration and development. And in the lead-up to the global discussion and in the lead-up to the global discussions on the post-2015 development agenda. This meeting presents a real opportunity to further embed migration as a development tool in the minds of policymakers and world leaders. We are privileged today to have Mr. Victor Vavrika, Deputy Head of Mission of the Embassy of Switzerland, on our panel. It is pleasing to see Switzerland playing an increasingly important role in the debate and discussion of migration issues. Professor Vitit needs no introduction in Bangkok. He is a world authority on human rights issues and is renowned throughout the UN system for his work in the area. In the interest of time, I will not go into more detail as biographies for both our esteemed panelists have been included in your folders. One thing missing from the biographies that you will be interested to know is that Professor Vitit is also a member of the International Labour Organization's Committee of Experts on the Application of Conventions and Recommendations. I would like to personally thank Ms. Rabab Fatima for her work in organizing and convening this meeting. I will finish by welcoming you all again, thanking you for your participation, and wishing you a constructive and productive afternoon ahead. With that, I hand over to Dovlin to present the key findings of the paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Good afternoon to everyone. Many thanks for kind introduction, Andy, and many thanks to all of you for joining us on this discussion. On behalf of the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, let me say that we're very thrilled to have started this partnership with IOM 2 years ago and to have continued this partnership in introducing the Issue in Brief series here in Bangkok. As Andy mentioned, we are now on the 9th Issue in Brief, and at IPI, I look forward to producing more of these briefs in the months. The topic for the 9th issue is very timely, as Andy has mentioned. The Global Forum on Migration and Development will be convened exactly a week from today in Stockholm, Sweden. 6 GFMD meetings have been convened so far here in Asia, in Europe, in North America, and Africa over the last 7 years. The hosts of the forum alternate between developed and developing countries. The first meeting was in Belgium, and the Philippines hosted the next meeting right after Belgium, followed by Greece in 2009, Mexico, Switzerland, and Mauritius in 2012. Last year there was no GFMD. The United Nations convened the high-level dialogue on migration and development to the GFMD And this year, Sweden is hosting the JFMB, and next year, Turkey will be hosting the JFMB in Istanbul. Let me start by saying something that I think almost all commentators on the JFMB would agree on, and that is the fact that the meetings have been quite successful so far. There was a 2012 assessment that was commissioned by the JFMB to inform us of whether the JFMB has been successful, and in that survey of governments, they found that 80% of governments think that they have great or general satisfaction with the JFMB process. 150 governments attended the last meeting in Mauritius in 2012. The Swedes just announced last week that almost 700 delegates will be coming to Stockholm next week. The same number of governments are coming next week to attend the JFMB. So certainly participation in this meeting has been and always been quite high and continue to do so. I think the question so far is that expectations are still quite high and how do you meet those expectations. We wanted to put more time for the discussion, so I'll be brief and highlight five key observations on the JFMB that myself and Secretary Melvin Lewis, who is the co-author for this brief, she is a secretary at the Commission in Philippines overseas of the government of the Philippines. I'll share with you these five observations and then we can move on to some of the comments. Let me start by saying that governments in the region have been actively engaged, not just as participants to the forum, but as leaders driving its direction and continuity. For instance, virtually every country in the region now has assigned representatives to JFMB's network of country focal points. The focal points they directly lay to the host government, this year in Sweden, and also the JFMB support unit, and coordinate JFMB-related preparations at the national level. There's also a troika, which consists of the current, the previous, and the future hosts of the meeting, and they basically govern the forum. Since the Philippines hosted the second JFMB, and the first developing country to do so, and the only country in Asia to do so, the Philippines has been very active in governing the forum, especially in the first 3 years of its implementation. Seven countries from the region are also part of a steering group, that is Australia, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Japan, Philippines, Korea, Republic of Korea, and Thailand. And these countries have been part of the JFMB steering group since its inception in 2007. That India joined in 2009, and these countries have been quite active in the JFMB. Governments in the region have also been actively contributing to the roundtable and thematic meetings of the forum, either as co-chairs or team members in charge of preparing the actual roundtables in these meetings and identifying speakers, writing concept notes, etc. Among the countries in the region, Bangladesh has been especially active. It has co-chaired at least one JFMB roundtable in every JFMB meeting over the last 7 years. You also have other countries like Australia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, co-chairing at least two roundtables over the last 7 years. And Sri Lanka co-chairing one roundtable. Three countries from the region have also been actively involved in assessing the value of the JFMB. So you have Bangladesh, India, and the Philippines, part of a 14-member assessment team that Switzerland chaired in 2011 to examine the JFMB process. And this assessment looked at the JFMB structure, what is the impact of the JFMB, what is the relevance of the JFMB, and the findings of this assessment actually get critical in applying the future of the forum. Now, this the Asia-Pacific region's active engagement in the forum has actually shaped the themes and the topics over the last 7 years, influencing the discourse on migration and development. So just to give you an example, as we know, there's a lot of temporary labor migration in the region. And it's not surprising that the topic of temporary labor migrants, especially the rights of migrants, have been quite at the forefront of the JFMB debate. When the Philippines took over from Belgium, the 2008 JFMB, the Philippines chose the issue of protecting and empowering migrants for development. At that time, it was a controversial move, but turned out to be a topic that many countries actually are willing to talk about. So the issue of migrant rights which is important to the region, has been quite central at the forefront of the GFN debate, and that is due to the active participation of some governments here. The question, though, for us is if the GFNDs remain relevant in the years to come, it must not just only shape the discourse on migration involvement, it must also be substantial in actually shaping the reality on the ground. There is a demand among member participants today for a more development-focused and results-driven forum. Here. As we know, although the discourse has changed over the last 7 years, a lot of the situation of migrants here in the region has changed. Very little of the region is still home to 3/4 of the world's population. Many migrants within it work in low-skilled, low-wage, temporary, and secure jobs. A huge number of migrant workers are still undocumented. Many suffer from abusive practices of recruitment agencies. In other words, you could change the discourse at this level, but the reality on the ground has changed very little. And the challenge, and for many observants of the GFND, is how do you actually not just change what we talk about in conference rooms like this, but change the reality on the ground. And this is some direct quotes from the assessment that the Swiss Commission concluded. So they're saying that main outcomes of the GFND so far has been dialogue, contacts, changes to good practices, but the impact on the national level is considered to be weaker. They're saying that there's a regret for lack of practical policy outcomes, certain bias towards migration issues in contrast to development issues. The civil society has also spoken quite strongly in the last GFND in Mauritius. Usually the civil society would come up in a official statement recommending to states what they wanted to achieve. In Mauritius, they actually came up with benchmarks and mechanisms for actions. And in their statement, they were very clear that they are in the GFND for change. Now, this leads me to my fourth my fourth observation, which is that the GFND could actually provide more opportunities for collaboration between interested governments and migration stakeholders, and more importantly, actively report on the progress of whatever these collaborations have been. There's also a huge demand right now for shaping the international priorities and agenda on migration and development. And the question is how do you do those two things? In the policy brief, we have identified some of the things that could be done to actually meet these goals of fostering more collaboration and shaping the international priorities and agenda. And we think that one way to do it is by enhancing the linkages to regional foreign processes. The GFND is now working sort of like the international forum, but the links with what's happening at the regional level is still not there. There are a number of regional efforts, especially here in many of the regions, such as the global process, the Abu Dhabi dialogue, the Mali process, a lot of discussions going here among governments, and we think that it's important to find synergies and also create more opportunities for mutual learning and cooperation between regions, so that the forum could actually broker and facilitate. It is also important to create a more dynamic people-to-people networking platform for policymakers so that they could actually use the GFND to find partners, to test ideas, to develop policy and programmatic tools. Currently, there is a platform for partnerships within the GFND, and if you go to that website, for instance, you can look into links to some of the policy initiatives governments have taken, links to handbooks, both of them produced by IOM, one with MPI, which is on diaspora engagement. I didn't have it there with you outside, and a number of links to what governments are doing. But what's the missing link, I think, is that the linking of the people to the knowledge. We could have access to the knowledge of what governments have done, but the GFND could actually provide people-to-people networking that would be crucial for showcasing what has been GFND's impact on migration involvement, governance, and how to make changes as needed. Another way to do it is actually to come up with a more focused, action-oriented, result-driven process for the next 5 years in a number of priority areas. In the brief, we have outlined five priority areas. And this is based on what we have heard from official statements by governments in the region, from international organizations working actively here, from civil society members, statements made during the second half of the dialogue on immigration development. I am not going to discuss what those priority areas are. I believe that we will be able to discuss it more in length later, but let me just identify five things we think is a priority. One would be developing a framework for assisting migrants coming to crisis, the need for gender responsive policies and programs, evidence-based data-driven policymaking, issues of recruitment costs for migrants, and this is quite important, I think, mainstreaming migration to the national development agenda and the post-2015 development agenda. Let me just tackle that one last priority area, which is in the post-2015 development agenda. The forum is taking place in the lead up to the post-2015 development agenda discourse, and there's a growing call right now among governments in the region to integrate migration into this agenda. Before this session, we had a discussion of the post-2015 development agenda and the difficulties in actually integrating migration into this international discourse and development. Sweden, we had actually had a teleconference with the government of Sweden, with Eva Ackerman-Borge at FBI. And in that conference 2 weeks ago, Eva mentioned quite strongly that the GFMV will be sending a strong message that migration has a place in the development agenda, and that it is a priority for Sweden. To have migration into the development agenda. This is an important, I think, next step for the GFMB, because if migration is incorporated into the development agenda, then there will be much more focus on measure and having a baseline in measuring impacts and results. And that is, I think, the next step for the GFMB, is to show that the process is not just a yearly meeting for governments, but really something that could actually have results that matter to migrants on the ground. Let me end here. If you need more information about us, that's our website, and that's how you can contact me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dovlin, for framing the issue so succinctly. One of the things that struck me, and I think all of us who are familiar with the GFMD are rather impatient with this issue of, it shapes the discourse well, but how do we change the reality on the ground? And I think Dovlin explained that quite clearly, but the process has certainly come a long way, and the discussion is much more open than we'd expected it to be. And yet the migrant worker building the stadium in Doha or wherever he's building it has not really been that much affected yet by this whole process. And how do we get there? I think that's one of the big challenges. Anyway, let me stop there and begin and with asking the first of our panelists, Mr. Viktor Vavrika, for his comments on the issue. Okay, Mr. Vavrika, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bruce. And thank you, first of all, to IOM and MPI for their invitation and this opportunity to share some Swiss views on the issue of migration and development. Myself personally, I'm from the embassy. I don't have a distinct background on the issue, but I was given some interesting information from my capital. In the Swiss perspective, migration has always been an individual response to seek better life, overcome poverty, mitigate risks, or flee from danger. And in recent years, migration has increasingly been recognized also as a development enabler around the world. But we also know from experience that migration is far from being a panacea for all development challenges, and that it bears risks and constraints. In international fora, we note that there is a significant shift on how the constraints, challenges, and opportunities of migration and development are being analyzed, and that's a good thing. The picture is more balanced now, the policy proposals better informed, and effective partnerships between all stakeholders, government, civil society, private sector, are emerging. The current dynamics and complex patterns of global mobility suggest that states can neither effectively govern migration nor unlock its full human development benefits through internal policies alone. Only more coordination and cooperation between countries and with other stakeholders will be able to achieve this. And in this process of changing both knowledge and practice on migration, the Global Forum on Migration and Development has had a pinnacle role since 2007. It is therefore a highly welcomed initiative by both IOM and MPI to have written this issue in brief paper that we have before us and brought us together here today to exchange thoughts on the specific perspectives from the Asian Pacific region. I would like to structure my brief comments in three parts. First, a short summary of my government's approach to the dialogue processes. Then, secondly, an external view on the proposed five priority areas for the region, as highlighted in the issue in brief paper. And then to conclude with some thoughts on the ongoing post-2015 process and the need to include migration. The dialogue processes have to be interlinked at all levels to be able to shape both policies and practices around migration and development. Global processes have to be substantiated by the discourse at regional and national levels, as much as these levels have to be inspired and guided by the GFMD or the outcome of the second UN high-level dialogue that was held in October 2013 in New York. The latter has been a watershed moment for adopting the first UN Declaration on Migration and Development, a document which should guide our future debate and which should also be included in the conference documents. The high-level dialogue also saw an inspiring 8-point plan that was presented by the UN Secretary General and a constructive 5-year 8-point plan submitted by more than 600 civil society organizations. Switzerland is convinced that, of the relevance of debating migration and development within the UN and sees the complementarity with the GFMD. And we will therefore support all regular UN high-level dialogues in the future. Switzerland has welcomed the initiative to discuss the situation of migrants in crises. Unfortunately, not only the Libyan case has shown the urgency to address the existing gaps. In a similar line of thinking, Switzerland and Norway have launched the Nansen Initiative to address the challenges and protection gaps of cross-border displacement in the context of natural disasters. Australia, Bangladesh, and the Philippines are members of the steering group, but of course all the governments are invited to join the group of friends of Nansen Initiative. With regard to the five priority areas that are mentioned in the issue in brief paper, starting on page 7, I would like to particularly welcome the mentioning of gender-responsive policies and programs, the second point that is mentioned, as a priority area. In Southeast Asia, we're convinced, for example, women who migrate for work are exposed to high risks, which range from gender-based discrimination to exploitation and severe human rights violations. Switzerland therefore supports the UN Women's Regional Program on Empowering Women Migrant Workers. This program aims to empower vulnerable migrant women in a gender-responsive way and to strengthen their access to effective legal protection. Empowering them and strengthening governments in sending and receiving countries to promote and protect their rights will contribute to making migration a positive experience for women, creating jobs, income, opening opportunities for choices and independence, and for learning valuable skills. On the point on page 8, evidence-based and data-driven policymaking. Here, knowledge, data, evidence, these are all essential preconditions to understand and to address migration in a coherent, coordinated, and effective manner to the benefit of all. And Switzerland is therefore supporting a World Bank initiative called Global Knowledge Partnership on Migration and Development, NOMAD, with a broad participation of experts from governments, international and civil society organizations, as well as scholars. The platform has embarked in a challenging endeavor to improve the knowledge of all actors involved in the field of migration. Topics of great interest to the region are currently being discussed within 12 thematic working groups, and their outputs will certainly benefit policy development processes. Another remark on recruitment, also on page 8 of the issue paper, but maybe with a slightly different twist. Ethical and fair recruitment practices for us represent an essential element to ensure protection and the well-being of migrant workers. Switzerland recognizes the urgency and relevance to engage in this sector. In this perspective, we presently support various initiatives and processes in sending countries. In Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Nepal, for instance, we support a better regulation and monitoring of the recruitment industry. Ethical and fair recruitment requires a multi-stakeholder approach in which governments, the private sector, the trade unions, and the civil society have an important role to play. And in addressing the fifth point on the issue in brief paper, the one on mainstreaming migration into national development priorities and the post-2015 development agenda, allow me to expand just a little bit on the ongoing process of defining a new global sustainable development agenda post-2015. You may be aware migration was not included in the Millennium Development Goals, and today the international community has, however, come a long way in formulating a coherent migration and development narrative in assembling vast and a growing knowledge on their interrelations and exemplifying how migration has contributed to the achievement of all 8 Millennium Development Goals. Omitting migration in the new sustainable post-2015 development agenda would exclude one of the key defining global phenomena shaping the 21st century. The Swiss government is therefore actively promoting the broad inclusion of migration in the agenda, most recently at a very successful global expert meeting held in Dhaka that was graciously hosted and co-organized by the government of Bangladesh. For the Swiss government, the following are four key arguments in favor of including migration and development into the post-2015 agenda. First, migration is first and foremost about people, their human rights and fundamental freedoms. Migration is a human experience and a cumulative outcome of individual choices and opportunities, or a lack thereof. And it is about the understandable will of people to overcome adversity and live a life in security and prosperity. Second argument, migration matters for human development and poverty reduction. Evidence from around the world highlights the fact that remittances contribute to the reduction of poverty and stimulate human development. With most migrants moving from a less to a more developed country, they tend to realize large average gains in terms of income as well as in health and education outcomes. Third argument, migration matters for economic growth and job creation. Migration is also about transfer of knowledge and technology, about filling critical gaps in labor markets and responding to demographic changes in our societies. migrants promote innovation, creative businesses help to develop new markets, provide and consume goods and services, expand tax bases, render traditional sector economically viable, and support social security schemes in countries with aging populations. And sometimes migrants even end up as Swiss diplomats, like myself. Migration, and this is the fourth argument, also has negative side effects which need to be addressed. This includes brain drain and brain waste, to human trafficking and migrant smuggling. Receiving societies may encounter challenges in ensuring social cohesion and effective integration policies. And together with their families, migrants can bear a heavy burden, including separation from families, as well as discrimination, human and labor rights violations, as well as debt bondage. So with these four arguments, and I would like to conclude with this, let's hope that the international community will give a strong political signal in Stockholm for the inclusion of migration in the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. And thank you again for this opportunity, and congratulations on the very excellent issue in brief paper. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Vavrika, for your excellent comments. The last two points will resonate extremely well with my IOM colleagues, who have been spending quite a lot of time on the ethical recruitment and the post 2015 development agenda, but very points that we wholeheartedly agree with. Thank you very much. Now I'd like to ask our next panelist, Professor Vitit, if he could make his comments. So.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. It feels a bit like a holiday to me. It's a sort of vacation from Thai politics. So I'm not going to talk about internal affairs. Happily this afternoon I'm talking about external affairs, slightly, with internal implications. I'd like to independently assess the paper from a variety of perspectives. One is what surrounds it in terms of context, and then intrinsically what it's trying to offer next after it having been through a certain process already in several years in terms of the Global Forum. In regard to the circumference, the environment around the paper, I think there are five considerations to be borne in mind. Number one is migration and development obviously concern a variety of stakeholders, and sadly, at times, victims, including some who are marginalized by the development process, who are flowing, in flux, outflow, in transit, and others who are forced to leave even more cogently through a variety of circumstances. So we are having to address a variety of migrants, sometimes a bit more voluntary in terms of their movement, and sometimes less voluntary, in other words, coerced, forced migration. So although the paper deals primarily with migrant workers, it should not forget the forced flow situation, particularly of refugees and internally displaced persons. And this has always been a challenge for IOM. In fact, I remember IOM from 30-plus years ago. Its best work then was very much on refugees, because IOM was transporting refugees from Thailand, particularly to Vietnam and others, very quietly. Great work was done then, as a matter of added. So I leave that as a thought, because where we go depends upon where we come from in terms of our matter of added. But don't forget the forced migrants, please. Secondly, obviously you've got countries of destination, countries of origin, countries of transit, and the internal process of areas of destination, areas of transit, areas of origin. And in the perspective of the analysis, it's interesting that one comment I really like very much, which should be supplemented by another comment, is this. The issue is not, I quote, it is not whether migration can benefit migrants and countries of origin, but how it does. Now, we're talking about countries of origin in terms of remittances and so on. But I have another phrase I want to add, and it's this. Equally important is this. The issue is, or it's not, is whether migration, forced or voluntary, can benefit the migrant and the country destination, and how it does. In other words, let's not just forget the country of destination either, because we have a whole challenge in terms of convincing countries of destination that Einstein was a refugee, still. And we know that Einstein was a refugee and did very well. Or if it's the Rohingya in this region that Iran has to deal with, well, are Rohingyas of benefit to countries of destination or not? Prove it. I'd like to see positive profiles. I've said this to the Rohingya groups already. We need positive profiles, success stories of migrants, including forced migrants, who land up in countries of destination. And that is part of the how, in terms of the psychology of acceptance and inclusion. Thirdly, we know that the Global Forum has been a value added in terms of bringing governments together. It doesn't pretend to be otherwise, but does it want to be otherwise? And if you really want to be otherwise, then you've got other P's coming in. I've got five P's for you as a holiday this afternoon. Number one is people at large, multi-stakeholders, you and me. I just migrated from Switzerland actually last week. I was before the UN Committee Against Torture. Second P is parliaments. You really want to convince legally, legislature-wise, locally? You need to work with parliaments too. Thirdly, public institutions, a whole variety. But I won't forget the courts or independent institutions which are public, like the Human Rights Commission, ombudspersons, and so on. Fourthly, the private sector. And fifth, the planet. Five P's. Now, where are we going from that value added of governments, which has been the value added of the global discourse under this setting? Fourthly, of course there's been value added in terms of dialogue. And I think every dialogue doesn't just want to do dialogue. It wants some tangible results, ultimately, in terms of results. But given that IOM and the whole discourse, well, is intergovernmental, but it's not quite UN either. And yet we have a whole framework of the UN paralleling it or complementing it. The question is this. Given the value added so far, do we go UN plus or minus UN? Is it a UN plus process? We can't forget them because we've got standards and so on. Or is it UN minus or something else in the middle in terms of migrating to and fro from the UN? And I don't forget this because there are standards and so on coming into play, which is the fifth issue, and that is we have plenty of standards and so on coming into play in terms of providing some of the substance to the discourse. And I don't want to forget the famously unratified UN Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers and Families. I know Bangladesh has ratified, Thailand has not. Few destination countries have ratified. Why? There's hesitation. Or maybe it's not the right forum, but we can't forget it. It's still there, guiding the substance of what it's about. And I helped the ILO, at least two ILO conventions. ILO Convention 97 on migration for employment, which stipulates many things we're talking about, like fair pay, remittances, remuneration, protection of migrant workers, so on, particularly those crossing borders. And then ILO Convention 143, which is on migrant workers, supplementary provisions, which is really protection from exploitation, including trafficking. It was there a long time ago, even before all these new conventions and so on trafficking. That was a long time ago. ILO was covering it. You can go along with it, or you don't have to go along with it, but it's there. And maybe it can also be used somewhere. So that's the initial environment behind what we're talking about. Secondly, the paper gives us an inkling of what's happened over the past few years, and then it posits a troika, a triptych of possibilities for the future. Number one, enhanced linkage at the regional level, or with regionalism, in terms of processes and institutions and so on, fora. Number two, more people-to-people platforms with pilot projects, ideas, tools, and so on. And number three, more focused action, action-oriented, results-driven processes over the next 5 years, including the five elements that my friend Victor has laid out, including more gender specificity and post-15 MDGs. And the paper gives us an inkling of what's happened in terms of various conferences and so on, including linkage with civil society, labour migration, etc. Well, I think ultimately there are three prongs which are being voiced by this paper, and let's have a look at them, bearing in mind that we are progressing towards a very sexy year, which is 2015, because it's post-MDGs, 2015. It's ASEAN community building by 2015. You will wake up in 2015 and feel totally different, I believe, or not. But anyway, it's being marketed that way, so let's use it well. Let's have a look at the three major concerns. Number one, the synergies with regionalism. Well, I mean, you can't forget ASEAN. ASEAN community, 2015, I mean, touted around is AEC mainly, ASEAN economic community. Well, actually, that's forgotten the other two communities where the migrants fit in, you know. We actually got three communities being built by 2015. ASEAN economic community, ASEAN political community, and ASEAN sociocultural community. Migrant fate is often in all three, not just one. And yet the marketing is AEC, AEC, and I don't want to forget that they're the other two. And even if you look at AEC, ASEAN economic community, just like in Europe and elsewhere, it started off with free trade of goods. And the point of 2015 is that it's much more than free trade. It's about services, liberalization, it's about investment, it's about techno exchange and so on. And in opening up to services, that's where the migrants come in, most concretely, in terms of opening up. We're opening up to skilled workers, particularly through mutual recognition agreements, as well as liberalizing services, up to 10 sectors, primarily. So, the skilled workers are allegedly like me and you sitting here, to some extent, shamefully or not. But what about the unskilled workers and the no-collar workers? They're there, but almost as a substratum of the interest. There is an ASEAN declaration on migrant workers, but they're still debating about the rights issue, they're still debating on a possible ASEAN convention on rights of migrant workers. In other words, the people who get affected most by development, underdevelopment, in the process, still have to be lifted up in terms of the priority. I'm not so concerned with skilled workers, expatriates, even though I can love them and their children. I'm equally concerned with those who are not skilled workers, who legitimately have to be part of the ASEAN agenda. And that's what we have to work on, while we can laud mutual recognition agreements and beyond, or 10 service, 9 service liberalization. It's much more than services in hotels and banking. It's the ordinary person who may be crossing the border and how we treat him or her, and the children too. And that's ASEAN. But what is good is that the paper also enables us to see that it's much more than ASEAN. Could be ASEAN Plus. I'm happy to see the Abu Dhabi dialogue, having just passed through Abu Dhabi on the way to nearby Syria. I'm happy to note that we have a Pacific process. I'm happy to note that we shouldn't forget about West Asia, South Asia, Pacific Asia, Central Asia, North Asia. We have plenty of migrants coming into this region, you know, North Korean asylum seekers, refugees. They're migrants who are legitimately part of the agenda, and they are happily not returned to the country of origin, and they have quick processing, particularly to South Korea, for example. Bali process also. Trafficking, etc. All these things are sort of mentioned along the way. But particularly in that perspective, I don't want to forget that for the post-15 agenda, Millennium Development Goals, whether or not we insert migration as a substantive issue, I'm pretty sure that there's going to be at least one goal on partnership, because MDG also has a goal on partnership, as well as a goal on environmental sustainability. And these are opportunities to integrate some of these concerns in terms of migration. It's not just about your skilled worker. It's not just about your voluntary or those who cross without being coerced. It's also about the others who are not being voluntary in terms of movement. So protection of people fairly in different states and stages of movement and development is something you should bear in mind, integrated somewhere in the post-MDGs, under the first topic of regionalism in terms of the synergy of regions. The second bifurcation, or it's not, it's the second track actually, of the people-to-people links, also offers opportunities. I know that we're asking now, do we move beyond the governments as stakeholders in the whole process of Global Forum? But if we really want to link up with people to people, of course, we can't avoid talking about individuals and communities and so on. And ultimately, their participation and power and protection, all very important. And there are guidelines on this already, including the various instruments I've referred to, such as the UN Convention on Migrant Workers, the ILO Conventions, various declarations and so on. And for the post-MDG 2015, I'm pretty sure that we're going to have a goal on poverty. For the pre-2015, we've had a goal on reduction of absolute poverty by half, something that Southeast Asia, particularly Thailand, did a long time ago. We're into MDG plus. So I would guess that one preferred goal, which will have impact on migrant workers, will be not just reduction by half, but elimination of poverty, calculated at least by roughly $1 a day. So not just reduction by half of people, but reduction by whole where possible. And that could be linked with other elements such as social protection floor for all, non-discrimination, etc., including cooperation between countries of origin, transit, and destination, as well as cross-cultural cooperation between different communities. And then finally, I come to the third main area, which is how do we become more action-oriented, result-oriented under this global framework that we've had for several years. And we've heard five possible sub-elements, including migrants, course, and crisis, gender issue, evidence, remittances, and post-2015 agenda. Well, I'll put it this way in terms of prospects for the future. Number one is that it's good to have intergovernmental dialogue. And if we're really thinking about dialogue with some action concerned, there are various elements that we should bear in mind, which I will address in a moment. Secondly, I think that a good entry point is to look at it from the partnership angle between different stakeholders. So that will fit in very nicely with the current MDGs as well as first MDGs. Thirdly, in terms of various doables in terms of actions related to the discourse or dialogue we've had, ultimately, we can't escape from these possibilities in some preferred actions. Number one, good laws, including laws concerning cross flows, either internal or external. Number two, good policies, and we have MOUs, we have some management-related policies. Thailand has MOUs with all the neighboring countries on migrant labor, for example, some of which work sort of all right, Malaysia, I think, to some extent, some of which more challenging, Myanmar. Thirdly, some good programs and practices, and everybody likes to talk about best practices. Everybody gets on board. We analysts have to look at less preferred practices as well in terms of what not to do. Fourthly, mechanisms and personnel. We claim now that we have focal points in every country, which is fine. Well, let's get them to work to support various actions as well. Fifth, resources, money and non-material resources, good volunteers, social capital. Sixth, information and monitoring, and that is voiced by one of the five sub-elements in this third big component. Seven, development and capacity building through education, and that's very doable and certainly voiced. And then eight, participation, process of reform, mobilization, so on for change. So all those are possibilities in terms of some entry points, slightly beyond dialogue, sort of action-oriented dialogue that we may be prospecting for the future. In terms of cross-terrain, cross-cultures, cross-countries, cross-borders, cross-peoples. And then finally, I would just come to two other considerations. The post-MDGs, well, in terms of framing it for the future, if the Global Forum has been happening for several years, then prospecting for the future as linked with post-MDGs will be also framed temporally as well as substantively. Where will post-MDG go? 15 years or 30 years? Who knows? But at least you can also look ahead in terms of maybe 15 years or longer term to 30 years, and some are already planning along that way. And then finally, in terms of substantive inputs of post-MDGs, you can have, as the current MDGs do, both a direct approach in terms of specific goals and or a generic approach in terms of more general goals. What do I mean? The specific goals today include elimination by half or reduction by half of those under $1 a day, whereas generic goals include environmental sustainability and the partnership, global partnership, which is much more flexible, sort of less defined. And I would haphazardly guess that the next phase may have more goals, more sub-goals, and they could be either specific goals and or generic goals. In other words, migration can be and should be addressed specifically or generically somewhere in the forthcoming goals. Not forgetting that we've still got to fulfill various goals of today in terms of pre-2015. Bear in mind that some considerations for the future include this. Management and enabling flows of migration in their various incarnations, in safety and dignity. In safety and dignity, not forgetting both forced cases as well as less forced cases. Secondly, today we're talking about social floor for all. In other words, non-discrimination in terms of basic assistance for all migrants, whether or not they are classified as illegal, illegal, irregular, or regular. Happily, in Thailand last year, the government, as it then was, introduced additional support for migrant workers generally, irrespective of whether they are considered to be regular and registered, particularly on health issues. And this is one way, one area where we have led the way in Thailand with the 30 baht medical scheme, particularly for registered people, but now something beyond those who are registered and so-called legal, to cover everyone in a non-discriminatory manner. So there we are in terms of basic protections for all, not forgetting partnership building, participation, and the choice is ours as to whether we cooperate with the five P's in terms of stretching our value added a bit further in terms of people, parliaments, public institutions, private sector, and or planet, given that partnership ultimately should benefit all. Thank you.
Good, thank you very much, Professor, for a most thought-provoking presentation. Many of us have heard Professor Vittit talk before, and he's always thought-provoking, so thank you again. It's very very good for our discussion here today. So let me now open the floor for comments, questions to our panelists, and also to Dovlin too, of course. So, yeah. And please introduce yourself when you begin to speak. So, Rick, you're up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Andy, and of course, congratulations. And Mikhail for producing this brief guideline. I cannot give comments from the perspective of a person who has been on the ground for 30 years of my life on migration. No? And first of all, I think all the commentaries are very thought-provoking, And one of the things that I'd like to share is my observation that I think GFMD gets dropped into the representation of the traditional institutions playing role in migration. I would observe that GFMD is actually much more traditional migration issues than development. In the past GFMD meetings, the country delegations were composed of ministries of foreign affairs and ministries of labor. And in the second half, we started to see national economic development institutions participating. And of course, on the side, you have CSO institutions. I think it is a very important observation, which even was highlighted during the Swiss chairmanship of GFMD in 2012, for the need to walk the talk and decentralize the GFMD process. And I think the only way to also jumpstart some reforms or changes to make this happen is to engage much more stakeholders who really matter to development processes. Because some of the agenda that has been tackled in GFMD, there are many other forums that are tackling the same issues. I think, for example, if I imagine migration and development, many stakeholders are wanting to hear about migration and human resource development, migration and political development, migration and legislative development, enterprise and industry development, trade development, employment development, technological development, migration and youth development, and urbanization matters that can be probably tackled when we engage more, as the professor said, the parliamentarians, the private sector, the line ministries who are dealing with these thematic areas. Hopefully, GFMD in each year that is happening is a gathering of other line ministries who have the structures and the mandates to implement action programs that really emphasize on the development aspects in this nexus. I am a strong believer also that private sector is an important mover of development, and I am really hoping that they have much more role to play in the dialogue.
Good, thank you very much. Rick, can I ask for anyone else who would like to? Yes, the distinguished delegate from Bangladesh, please.
Poverty reduction and economic development efforts in the country of origin. In its simplest form, I believe the migration, the benefits of migration to the destination country is much more higher than the source country, the country of origin. In simple terms, you can say that if the marginal propensity to save of the migrant worker, it can be a maximum 40%. In that case, you know, the contribution of the earning of a migrant worker to the destination economy is 60% and its country of origin is 40%. And I consider migrant worker as API, it's a foreign direct labor. It's in fact as good as API. So in subsequent policy debates, I would expect that, you know, I would really consider the benefits of migration on the destination economies. And of course, migration has a huge total cost, not only on the destination countries, but also countries of origin. And if we can manage this total cost, I think migration can be a truly, agent of change, both in the countries of origin and in the countries of destination. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you very much for your comments. More comments or questions from the floor? Sorry, yes, Vanessa, please.
I'm actually glad that this topic of benefits of migration to destination countries is coming up here again. And I think this is really a point for further research agenda for UN systems organizations, what we will further work on. Experience also shows that governments often have a hard time convincing their people of the benefits of migration. And I think this is also the point that, for example, Switzerland could bring in the discussion in the GMMD, because I think Switzerland is exactly in this position. So I think it could also be interesting in the future for countries of destination share their experience and their benefits, and for example, how to make the benefits of migration to destination countries known to the population in countries of destination, because migrants also face quite a lot of discrimination on the ground in terms of xenophobia. And I thank Professor Wittig for bringing in the contribution of refugee or forced migrants. I think while the contribution of labor migrants is easier to quantify and more evident, it may be more difficult to find evidence on the contribution of refugees, and just as a comment, this would be an exciting research agenda in the future, maybe also for universities. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Vanessa. This is a big area of governments accepting how much the contribution of migrants and then actually being prepared to discuss it with their constituents. They're often very shy about talking about it. Any more comments, questions, please? Robert, would you like to?
Thank you, Andy. I know there could be more questions, so maybe perhaps also to get some other reactions from the floor. Dublin's favorite, of course, presentation was excellent, and the two discussants, I think, brought in also newer elements to the discussion. But let me come back to more practical issues. I know that, you know, one of the things that Dublin said is that GFMD, you know, we have been discoursing, but what is the actual action-oriented, what is happening on the ground? How much does it reflect, relate to the practical situation on the ground? And in this respect, and this is a question from my colleagues coming in from the region, you are the people who deal with labor migration with your countries, with your host governments. Can you tell me, can you say how relevant you find GFMD to your national governments? We have the national focal points. If we can hear from you how relevant GFMD, we are actually meeting here just a week before the GFMD. I know some of our missions actually hold national consultations to prepare for the GFMD. But if you can hear a little bit more about the practical sort of issues, how relevant is GFMD to your national governments? And my next, since I have the floor, I just have two or three more observations, and this is to our Swiss colleagues. GFMD, when it was set up, it was also felt to be a bridge between between the developing and the developed world. So do you think GFMD has actually served its purpose to being bringing together the developing world's perspective and the developed world's perspective? And finally, to Professor Vithit, I mean, you know, you have touched upon some very fundamental issues, but very simply, if you can say, what role has the GFMD played in raising the migrants' rights agenda? Do you think that GFMD actually has, what will be your assessment of GFMD in that respect? I leave it at that, but one, I believe there are some colleagues here also from the civil society, and perhaps if we can also listen to them, how they view to be GFMD's relationship between the governments and the civil society. Thank you.
Good. Who would like to answer Rabab's questions?
Again, just to get everybody to talk.
Silence.
Come on.
Any of our IOM colleagues who are working with directly with governments, it'd be interesting to hear from you and what your governments that you work with, their opinion or the importance they attach to the GFMD. What about Thailand? Can anyone talk about Thailand? There are so many people from Thailand in the room.
I'm very surprised actually by the silence in the room, because I remember when I was serving in Bangladesh, we actually used to hold a national consultation to prepare for the GFMD. And this meeting used to be organized by IOM, and we used to co-chair the meeting with the government and bring all stakeholders in the room and actually go through the agenda and prepare inputs for that, for the GFMD. So I'm a bit surprised that we would like to, you know, hear from colleagues from the region how relevant it is. Yes, Christina.
Thank you for that introduction, because I am continuing that tradition now. So in Bangladesh, we have supported the government of Bangladesh to bring together many ministries and to be part of the pilot project of the GFMD on mainstreaming migration. So as we all know, the government of Bangladesh has made quite a commitment to migration, and so it's very important part of the global processes for the government of Bangladesh. Of course, we have a representative of the government of Bangladesh here, so I don't speak for you, of course, but I know for IOM, this is the feeling that we always have from our government counterparts. So, thank you.
As for Nepal, we also make a similar things in the past. We used to hold on to the discussions based on the thematic areas which will be presented in the Global Forum on Migration and Development. In the past, we've always hold a consultation in collaboration with ILO and UN Women. But it has always been at the initiation of the development partners in the case of Nepal, and we've had them to discuss some of these different recommendations. And also some of the civil society partners, they hold stakeholder consultation and they provide the recommendation to the world.
Thank you. Any more? Rick?
Okay. In the case of the Philippines, certainly I observe that there is a very good effect of GFMD on migration governance in the country. But I do see that a big part of it is when the IOM and other institutions such as the UN system and the EU, when they put forth resources to pursue certain concrete projects, to undertake certain tasks, time-bound projects that arose out of GFMD discussions. For example, the joint migration and development program, which is a UN-EU-ILM thing that's happening. I think it was able to get to cascade down the ground, the NGO community. And now we have a project on mainstream migration in local development. So local governance is now getting more politically sensitive and engaging in migration dance in the way they run their governance. And then there was the inspiration from the Swiss chairmanship to do migration profile in the Philippines. And because of IOM funding, we were able to do a country migration report, which constitutes their migration profile. The translation of global tools that the Global Migration Group had developed and the IOM developed into local adaptation has also been happening. And quite interestingly, in the last 2 years, in the development planning of the Philippines, there are already about 60 provisions of the development plan of the Philippines containing mention of migration in different chapters. So, and in larger development forum, shared by the president with the development organizations and partners, migration is a topic of interest to many institutions. And to tell you that, for example, the Department of Agriculture is so sensitized to realize that they have a role to play in migration and development, because if they do not provide an environment conducive to agricultural enterprise investment by migrants, then all this talk will not be very useful. Nowadays, advocacy for the roles of the line departments, including Department of Energy, who should provide stable power supply in the provinces so that migrants can be lured to come back home and invest, is starting to be realized. So I think these are good indicators, but however, as I said, it only happens in the Philippines because there are these things happening in the Philippines because there are concrete projects that follow through funded by donors and IOM.
Good, thank you. Rick Bruno, please.
Thanks, Andy. I come from a country which is exactly on the opposite side of the spectrum from Philippines and Nepal and Bangladesh. So I come from Timor Leste, where little migration is quite an exotic term at this point. And I was meeting recently with the Secretary of State for Labor and Employment, who discussed also the global forward migration development. And he asked a question that is quite enlightening for some particular small country, yes, but is it usual to start or is something useful? So the idea is there are not many questions getting involved in a philosophical debate about migration development, but the problem is that they're looking for some concrete outcomes, something that can take back, something that can think how to implement in their own specific environment. So, and I think the situation of Timor Leste is shared by other countries, including transition countries, starting with the process of developing a new migration management system. So this is something we have to consider also, how to engage in the situation.
Good. Thank you. Some more comments, or there were Rabab posed a couple of questions for the panelists, gentlemen. You want to start?
I actually just want to react to the remark that was made by the colleague from ESCAP on the problem of preaching the benefits of migration to the people of a receiving country. That's obviously quite a challenge. And from the Swiss perspective, we I don't want to give the impression that Switzerland is preaching abroad something else that it actually does internally, because that's not the case. But in Switzerland, maybe it's a bit of a particular situation with the direct democratic institutions that we have to an extreme, doing all this work of convincing the voter of the benefits of migration. That's a very difficult task. And in Switzerland, you may know, we have a ratio of foreigners that has topped 20% now. So in the perspective of the average voter, we are reaching some limits of absorption of migrants. So that's part of a political process. It's not part of government policy not being there, or political will not being there, or even the economy is very much in favor of incoming migration, of course, and through all levels. I'm not just talking the white collars, also other labor workforce. There is still room for that. But as I said, the problem is a political process, and it's quite thorny to convince our rice farmers of the benefits of migration. Yeah, but direct democracy is a painful process. I'm sure some countries in the room here could subscribe to that.
Thank you very much. I like direct democracy. Swiss style, having learned a lot. You know, the swans in Geneva won, and the cygnets won, because they had to have a referendum on whether to build a tunnel near the place where the swans and the cygnets were laying eggs and enjoying peaceful existence with human beings. And they won.
The swans.
So they couldn't build a tunnel. That was direct democracy in terms of referendum. But of course, different countries adapt accordingly. Number one, I think it's really salutary that we're raising the issue of destination countries. And I think the mindset that we'd like to nurture is enabling is quite a good one, enabling a certain understanding cross-culturally of the possible contributions, inputs of migrants, migrant workers, including those from other countries. And the best way to do it is to start young. I've seen programs in the United Kingdom, for example, where maybe with the first generation of arrivals it's difficult in terms of acceptance, inclusion, and so on. But the second generation, it's much more easy as an opportunity for inclusiveness on both sides in terms of coming together in a very constructive manner. Secondly, when I said people as one of the P's, of course that covers CSOs, civil society, etc., in terms of partnership building. And the Global Forum has to decide whether that's a certain value added. Because some of the topics have been on civil society, but how substantively have we been, and do we want to be, rather than just dialoguing about it? Because, of course, when we have a whole range of civil society actors together, we have a lot more to work on in terms of pros and cons, pitfalls, challenges, and possibilities. Thirdly, the national focal points, it's interesting. I mean, most or many plans of action globally or declarations advocate some sort of focal point on something, and then maybe it's one ministry that's designated. And what I wanted to highlight was that actually a focal point very often has to be a very cross-ministry intersectoral affair that's very open-minded to civil society. For example, if we think that the question of migrant labor in Thailand, my beloved country, if we think that that's an issue for the Ministry of Labor, it is very incomplete, because it is irregular, or those coming in without papers, it's an issue for the police, for the military, for the immigration personnel, under the Ministry of Interior, or health, on health issues, or schooling, or education issues through the Ministry of Education. So whatever focal point really has to be very broad-minded and very intersectoral. in its reach. And I think also we want to, in any focal point, we want weight. We want political weight. If you've got a non-weighty focal point, then it becomes very blurred. It doesn't have the lens of high-powered commitment, ultimately. And finally, in terms of the question on where does the forum go on rights issues, well, if you look at the listing of forum dialogue so far, tentatively, they could all be on rights, tentatively. Nominally, they could all be on rights. I'll cite them. First one, civil society, private sector. Then second one, labor migration, mobility. Thirdly, policy coherence and mainstream. Then rights of migrants. We've had that already. Then governance of migration and coordination. Then data and research. Then irregular migrants and regular migrants. Then diaspora. And then the question of minimizing costs. And then remittances. They could all be on rights. I mean, I don't have a fixation on rights necessarily, but I'm saying that there are angles where you need to protect people in terms of their basic entitlements. For example, access to justice. Even if you are so-called illegal in the country, if you've been working, you must have access to your pay somehow. I mean, remuneration is not dependent on status. It's just a basic right. And in Thailand, we've had to adjust our possibilities there. We recognize that anyone has the right to education, irrespective of papers, don't have to be legal at all, so we have some access to education. Likewise, medical care, very, very important. And the better part of the international standards exactly highlight those possibilities in terms of protection of entitlements, irrespective of status and papers. For example, the UN Convention, like it or not, UN plus, UN minus, UN Convention on Rights of Migrant Workers covers all migrants, irrespective of documents and papers, at least on three or four issues, such as right to life and decent treatment, access to justice, education, and medical care. Doesn't cover freedom of movement in a country of destination if you're illegal, but it covers those other aspects. So there are certain aspects that can be highlighted, irrespective of status. And even if you're not a party to the convention, I think we should highlight them. And many countries like Thailand, we have our failings, but we've also been implementing quite a lot of these things. Exactly on the medical care, as you heard earlier, irrespective of status. So things can be done. Things can be done and not wait for formal commitments necessarily, while bearing in mind that if we have a dialogue, these are opportunities for us to share and care at the same time.
Good, thank you very much, Professor. Some more comments from the floor, or we'll... Dovlin, please.
It's really interesting from my perspective to hear about the need to readjust and look into the impact of migration on the destination country. As someone who has been working with a think tank focusing on migration policy, that question has actually been the question for migration policy folks for the longest time. So before 2005, I mean, there have been a lot of studies that looked into migrants' impact at the destination countries. Wage of the, depressed wage, what is the impact of migrants on accessing basic services at the destination. And in fact, it is the focus on migrants' impact on the destination, too much focus on it, is what pushed to change the discourse and also look into migration's impact, the country of origin. And this started a discussion about migration and development. The World Bank came up with a number on how much remittances is coming from the developed country. And now we have this full-blown discussion on migration and development. And it's interesting to see now we're shifting back the pendulum and really starting to question again. We might be losing the perspective of what migrants are actually contributing in a destination. I think that I was actually quite worried thinking that in the start of the GFNB, it was 2006, 2007, they were discussing, there was no global financial crisis then. European countries, the United States, were all doing very well, they were open to migration and discussing it. And it was really interesting that despite the global economic crisis, despite the problems in many of these destination countries, there was no backlash in terms of discussing migration and development. And the conversation continued. And I think part of that is the realization among destination countries that migration can help them too. And that has been, for instance, the discussion within the United States. Why do we need to come up with immigration reform? The argument was making the case that the United States need to make the pie bigger. We need to be more competitive, and we need to think about how we could get the migrants that we need. So in other words, I think there is that discussion, and it has to be framed much more in parallel to discussions on migrants' impact at the country of origin. And data would have a lot to do with that. And it's great. Switzerland is funding this huge effort, NOMAD, which I think, and everyone in the migration involved community thinks, would actually change a lot of the discourse on migration and development, because they're putting in a lot of resources into providing the information. Just one quick note on the migrants' rights agenda. I remember when I was starting at MPI, it was 2006, and there was a discussion about having migration and development at the UN level dialogue, and discussions about the global forum. And migrants' rights is not a topic that was mentioned very easily. And I think that right now the discourse has changed quite a lot. And we had a conference, a teleconference at NPI last week, where we had senior advisor to Peter Sutherland, who is the special representative of the Secretary General on Migration. And he was saying in that telebriefing that we agree on one basic assumption here, that we have to think about migrants' rights first, because we have to protect them so that they could make whatever contributions they make to the country of origin and the country of destination. So I think the migrants' rights agenda sort of found its place in the GFMB, and I think that's a good sign that the concerns of origin countries are very much reflected, at least in the discourse on the GFMB.
Thank you very much, Dovlan. Any more? Oh, yes, please.
I'm Basana from the FAA Capital Office in Thailand. I'd just like to bring some perspective on the meeting I had this morning. This morning we have discussed about the changing population structure in Thailand, with this not only Thailand but also in the region. Because right now, Thailand, we have been lower, and people are aging really fast. And we know that with that trend, it means that we need more people, migrants from living countries coming in. So my point is, I'd like to talk about two issues here. First one is about in one of the report is that I've got here, saying that we can talk about managing of south-south migration is about 33%, and north-south, and the second point I want to talk is about 5%. So first issue is about south-south or migration. More in Thailand, but it's about cross-border migrations, in which we have a lot of migrant workers from living countries coming to Thailand to supply the needs of the work that the Thai people no longer can do that. I support the Thai information that in terms of healthcare, that's something that Ministry of Health is trying to cover, extend coverage and benefits to cover migrant workers. But yet we're still struggling with a lot of barriers. Example, in terms of the interest of migrants to purchase a health card, to be able to access the health care in Thailand, for example. Second issue is about the perceptions and understanding of health providers who provide health care to migrant workers, plus language problems and all that. That can be some kind of initial barrier to think of. And secondly, in terms of policy, I don't think we have a very clear policy in terms of migration policy in this country yet. They often look at this issue from a national security perspective, but not in terms of where we, not in terms of protection, in terms of we still need more migrants coming to this country. So that the first observation of the south-south migration train. And the second one, again, in terms of north-south migration train, that probably, according to this year, is that it's about 5%. What I want to see is one pattern of migration in which that's not for economic migration, but in terms of health and welfare migration, because we know that aging is happening very fast. And we have seen train of some young elderly people from other regions migrating to Asia, for example, in which they need to have the health care, it's not only health care, institutional health care, but also caregivers. We have seen that increasing trend of that not only to Thailand but to other countries as well. And in terms of the future scenario, that's something that we need to at least stand up and with some special interest. So we should have that too.
Good. Thank you very much for those comments. any other comments? Anyone from civil society? We haven't heard any comments from civil society. No? I think I'll close it.
Would they like to add something?
Yes, just before we close this, I'll ask the panelists, would you like any final comments or your gentlemen?
Well, I hope that the forthcoming preparations for the next forum can bear in mind that 2015 is a very fashionable year. And since we would like to be substantively fashionable, use it well, because we don't have many 2015. If you know what I mean. So please get the message nicely across. Many of the messages here that I don't need to repeat. No less, no more, but at least no less than some of the protection issues that we're talking about. And these are doable things. You can cite Thailand and you can cite others. They are doable possibilities. Medical coverage for all. Even though some developed countries have not done as yet. That developing countries can also do. And South-South cooperation is something I welcome very much, and we know that this is something that is also being talked about, global reports and South-South. I hope that we, Asia-Pacific, will not be too egocentric, even though we can love ourselves with our selfies. I hope we can be sharing with Africans, with South Americans and others. So let's enable us to help and share, particularly while not neglecting other groups. You can start young with volunteer schemes, medical schemes between this region and Africa and others, learning from what we have. And very doable. Very doable. And great in terms of a psychological, empathetic nurturing of a certain understanding on the issue, as well as being action-oriented.
But thank you, Professor.
And from my side, just to thank you again for the opportunity to have the Swiss perspective in this event. And you have my contacts. If there is anything we can provide you with further, then don't hesitate to get in touch with me, and I can liaise with the colleagues back in Capital. But thank you very much.
Well, I think that we need to go to Istanbul too. To remind them how important 2015 is and how they can capitalize on what's going to happen in 2015, especially here in our region. Let me just say that I think, and I'm not just saying because I'm from here originally, but Asia-Pacific has, I think, among the other regions in the world, has the most to gain in terms of really linking migration and development. And we are the fastest growing region in the world. There's a lot of opportunities here, as you mentioned, ASEAN mobility by 2015. There's a lot of momentum, and I think, as research has shown, countries, middle-income countries, have most to benefit from migration, and we are in a region that would actually do that. And I think that it's just a matter of continuing the leadership that other governments in the region have done, Bangladesh and the Philippines, and getting on board other countries as well, because the opportunities are there and challenges are huge, but there's much to gain if we could actually get the discussion beyond discourses of justice into something that would really change the life of this person outside right now doing some work. Here in this country and in other parts of the world. Challenge is huge, but I think IOM is in a good position to face that challenge. Thank you so much, Jay.
Good. Well, I'd like to thank our two panelists very, very much for their contributions and a stimulating discussion. I thought it was very good and took us into new areas that I think were particularly interesting for all of us. I'd like to now hand the microphone to Rabab for the closing comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Nothing really to say, but it was very, very interesting. It was also a huge learning experience for me to listen to Professor Vithit and our colleague from Switzerland and Dublin. The paper was good, and I hope that it contributed to some extent in a better understanding of what GFMB stands for. And this is particularly true, I believe I'm addressing this to more my colleagues from the region, because they go back, they are the people who are on the ground assisting and working with their governments to move forward some of the agenda of the GFMD. I think the GFMD has come a full circle from Brussels to Stockholm, from HLD1 to HLD2. And when we meet in Stockholm, I think there will be a lot of stock picking taking place, because HLD2 last year also had some vision for the GFMD. And it is on the member governments and other stakeholders to see what will be the future of GFMD post-Stockholm. And I think in terms of concrete value addition, in terms of GFMDs, I am one of those advocates of the GFMD. I still have hope in the GFMD. And I think one of the biggest achievements has been to sort of mainstream migration discussion, migration discourse at a global level. That has happened. I think it's one of the big success has been also to bring around the table more countries of destination and countries of origin, and their willingness to discuss difficult issues also, and their willingness to increase partnership. And I think also now it is moving on to this next stage of getting into practical issues. And if you look at the GFMD agenda for Stockholm, the first two roundtables, roundtable one is actually talking about operationalizing mainstreaming of migration to development. I think that's real action. And then if you look at also another roundtable, which is actually talking about framing migration into the SDGs and the post-2015 development agenda. So there's much to look forward to, and I hope the colleagues from the region will continue to work to support their governments in taking those forward. And I would also like to thank our participants and guests who joined us from Bangkok, and we hope that you also found the discussion to be useful. And we are particularly grateful to our two discussants, Professor Vithit Muthaborn and Mr. Victor and of course Dublin, our dear friend, for their very valuable contribution to the discussion. And this is not the end of it. I mean, IOM will continue to work at the ground level, at the national level, as well as in the GFMD, to continue to support the process at the ground level, as well as in the global discourse. IOM, as you know, serves as the technical secretariat for the GFMD. We'll continue to do that. And we'll continue to also support all other processes leading to the post-2050 development agenda and integrating migration into that. With that note, I thank you once again, and I thank Andy, Mr. Andy Bruce, our regional director, for joining us and supporting the issues and briefs series. Thank you to everyone.